We have a little problem, as you all know. I'm the chair, so I need to start the session. But if there are some gentlemen who could run down to the master barroom and steal some more chairs from that room, I'm sure we can squeeze them in someplace and let some more people sit down. But we really do need to get going. Excuse my distressed appearance. I have been distressed. That's the reason. My name is Will Quist, and I'm the chair for this extremely popular session, most of which time will be spent hearing our speaker, George D. Smith. He has some interesting background. He earned a B.A. in political science from Stanford University. He is currently the president of Signature Books. He has been an editor of the book An Intimate Chronicle, the Journals of William Clayton, and also a compilation of essays on writing Mormon history called Faithful History. I will now turn the time over to him for 30 minutes, after which we'll hear from Professor B. Carmen Hardy of California for 10 to 15 minutes, and then if there's any time left, we'll be glad to hear questions from you. And that's all I have to say. Brother Smith.
Well, thank you for crowding into this very small room on what's turning out to be a warm afternoon. I was at a similar meeting a couple of years ago down at Stanford University at Branner Hall. There was a plural wife came to speak about her polygamous experience. She had just written a book or is writing a book, something to the effect, "My husband has 9 wives," and here is. This dorm is filled with all these freshmen, basically, and younger Stanford students just grinning and eager to find out what she's going to say. She saw this parent enthusiasm and said, "I'll bet you want to know how sleeping arrangements are settled, don't you?" And they all grinned and nodded. And her answers were very reasonable and rational, and they were quite surprised how normal it all sounded. I'm here neither to advocate nor denigrate the practice of plural marriage, but I have to confess an interest in what's a very curious and significant part of our American historical heritage. Polygamy, marriage to more than one spouse at a time, cannot be seen in the fossil record of our primitive ancestor, Homo erectus. And no one knows if Lucy of Olduvai Gorge was a plural mate. A recent study of the evolution of human sexuality, however, indicates that while modern man is often culturally obliged to be monogamous, he may be biologically built for polygamy. Therefore, it should not surprise us that polygamy has been practiced in many parts of the world. Plural marriage has been found in India, Nepal, China, the Middle East, Africa, Indonesia, Australia, in early Germanic tribes, among certain Indian societies of the Americas, Eskimos of the Arctic, and notably the Mormons of North America. Abraham, David, and Solomon had many wives, but Jewish law required monogamy by the 11th century in this era. Polygamy was also found in pre-Islamic Arabic cultures of the Middle East, Africa, and North Asia and North Africa. Later, the Quran limited Muslim husbands to a maximum of 4 wives. Polygamy was prohibited by the Justinian Code in the 6th century and is generally forbidden in Europe and the Americas, and was strictly against Illinois law when the Mormons secretly introduced the practice in 1841. Well, what's interesting to me is I always try to look at polygamy as a reflection of Joseph Smith or the Mormons or something unique to them, but they were not the first in America to think of plural marriage. In fact, for 3 centuries before Joseph Smith introduced Mormon celestial marriage, polygamy was a popular subject of public debate in Europe and America. In 1531, Martin Luther advised England's Henry VIII to, quote, "take another queen in accordance with the examples of the patriarchs of old, who had 2 wives at the same time." And 8 years later, Luther arguing that polygamy was allowed under the Mosaic law and was not forbidden in the New Testament, gave Prince Philip of Hesse a dispensation to take a second wife. since the Protestant Reformation had replaced papal authority with an inerrant Bible. The Old Testament polygamy became a persuasive argument for marital innovation in the 16th century. In 1534, John Bockelson of Leiden, Holland, led the Anabaptist in Munster, Germany, in 11 months of polygamy as they awaited the end of the world. This town of 15,000, not too different from the size of Nauvoo, had been purified of all infidels, that is, Catholics and Lutherans, and was expected to become the New Jerusalem. Revered as the prophet of the Lord, Bockelson issued 12 articles revealed to him by God, including sanction for a man to take as many women to wife as he wanted. Bockelson was proclaimed king and took 16 wives who were considered queens. Domestic arrangements were decided by a stick placed at the dinner table in front of the queen who had been chosen to spend the night with the king. In 1780, in England, the Reverend Martin Madan, the disciple of John Wesley who co-wrote Hark the Herald, advocated the restoration of biblical polygamy, which would, quote, return discipline to the sexual informality of the age, does it sound like today, correct a declining population, eliminate abortion, save innumerable women from ruin, and restore men to their rightful patriarchal role. During the years following 1817, American utopian Jacob Cochran taught a spiritual matrimony to communities in Maine and New Hampshire. It was sanctioned by a ceremony of his own within which any man or woman already married or unmarried could enter into, choosing at pleasure a spiritual wife or a spiritual husband. In the 1830s, John Humphrey Noyes and his perfectionist practiced another form of plural marriage. Settling in Oneida, New York in 1847, more than 500 men and women shared land, clothes, sex partners, and children. In 1837, when Mormon headquarters was located in Kirtland, Ohio, a Cleveland newspaper 15 miles away printed a letter which argued for polygamy as a remedy for the, quote, distress of so many old maids. If a man first obtained the consent of his wife, the writer asked, what evil would arise from allowing him, quote, as many more wives as he might judge proper? It would be more desirable to be the second or even third wife of a generous man than to remain an old maid, neglected and laughed at, and it would eminently lessen prostitution in one sex and ranging in the other. I really didn't know what ranging meant, but I figured it out. As we're all aware, Utah polygamy has received considerable attention, but any definitive study of Mormon plural marriage must begin with its roots, Nauvoo polygamy. From April 5, 1841, to the ceremonies concluded in 1846, the year of westward migration, this was the model and impetus for Utah polygamy and the practice that continues today. Although Joseph Smith met his death at the hands of outsiders, it was internal dissent precipitated by polygamy which brought him to the Carthage jail. Rumors about Smith's extramarital relationships with women had circulated for a decade before his 1841 plural marriage and the revelation sanctioning polygamy recorded in 1843. Although Mormon plural marriage was intended to remain a closely guarded secret, word that Joseph Smith and possibly other Mormons were practicing polygamy was surprisingly widespread among the towns and villages of western Illinois in the early 1840s. The secret became a scandal in May of 1844 when William Law, a counselor to Joseph Smith who equated polygamy within the restored church as concubinage, filed suit against Smith in the Circuit Court of Hancock County, Illinois. Law charged that Smith was living, quote, in an open state of adultery with Maria Lawrence, a teenaged orphan who was living in the Smith household. In fact, Smith had secretly married both Maria and her sister Sarah by the fall of 1843 and was serving as executor of their estate. Law apparently hoped that disclosing Smith's relationship would discourage him from continuing the practice, but instead he rejected the charge in front of a church congregation, excommunicated Law, and made these statements. Another indictment has been got up against me. I had not been married scarcely 5 minutes and made one proclamation of the gospel before it was reported that I had 7 wives. This new holy prophet, which is William Law, had gone to Carthage, the county courthouse, and swore that I had told him that I was guilty of adultery. What a thing it is for a man to be accused of committing adultery and having 7 wives when I can only find one. The following month, Law and other Mormon dissidents published the inaugural issue of the Nauvoo Expositor to reveal Smith's Nauvoo harem and its, quote, unparalleled and unheard of attempts at seduction. Declaring the Expositor a public nuisance, the Nauvoo City Council, led by the mayor, Joseph Smith, ordered all copies of the paper to be burned and its printing press destroyed. Well, as you can imagine, this action created an uproar through the state of Illinois, where Smith's growing political power as well as his alleged immorality were both feared and resented. When Governor Thomas Ford ordered Smith arrested, Joseph Smith and his brother were jailed at Carthage. And as we all know, on June 27th, a large mob overpowered the guards and shot the brothers to death. Well, how did the Mormon community arrive at this state of affairs? On July 12th, 1843, Joseph Smith dictated a 10-page revelation to his private clerk, William Clayton, which indicated that he meant to restore the ceremonies and cultural practices of ancient Israel. The revelation on plural marriage, or celestial marriage as it was called, claimed to restore the practice of Moses, Abraham, David, Solomon, having many wives and concubines, a new and everlasting covenant in which if any man espouse a virgin or 10 virgins, he cannot commit adultery, for they belong to him. A few months earlier, Clayton recalled, Smith also informed me that he had other wives living besides his first wife, Emma, and in particular gave me to understand that Eliza R. Snow, Louisa Beeman, Desdemona Fulmer, and others were his lawful wives in the sight of heaven. In fact, by the time of the 1843 revelation, Smith had married at least 12 women besides his legal wife, Emma, and about 15 of his most trusted followers had taken plural wives. About 40 years later, assistant church historian Andrew Jensen collected LDS marriage records and statements from Smith's former wives who willingly confirmed that they had consented to become the prophet's wife and that he, quote, associated with them as wives within the meaning of all that the word implies. Jensen published these statements in 1887 primarily in an attempt to convince the Smith family that their progenitor had in fact practiced polygamy. Just when Mormon polygamy began is conjectural, but it clearly commenced by April 5, 1841, with Smith's first officially acknowledged plural marriage. In a ceremony beside the Mississippi River, he married 26-year-old Louisa Beeman, disguised in a man's hat and coat. The ceremony was performed by her brother-in-law using words dictated by the prophet. At that time, Smith was 35 and had been married 14 years. To 36-year-old Emma Hale Smith. They had 5 living children. During the 2.5 years from his first official plural marriage in April 1841 to the last known marriage in 1843, Joseph Smith took as many as 42 wives, one or two at a time. By the close of 1843, Emma Smith's biographers observed, most friends of Smith's legal wife had either married her husband or had given their daughters to him. Some of the younger women were discreetly instructed in polygamy by older women who had been inducted previously into the secret order. Smith courted these plural wives with an offer of celestial marriage, which promised to unite a man and woman not only for time, that is, until death, but for eternity where they eventually could become gods. A charismatic, handsome man, Joseph Smith apparently had little trouble persuading young girls that he was their way to eternal realms of glory. 16-year-old Lucy Walker, for example, had been adopted by the Smiths and worked as a maid in a Smith home. The prophet told Walker that God had commanded him to take her as a wife. She was at first angry and insulted, but she feared Smith's warning that if she rejected the principle, the gate will be closed forever. On May 1, 1843, while Emma was shopping for supplies in St. Louis, Lucy married Joseph Smith. For young women living in the Smiths' home, the prophet's advances were hard to resist. After the death of their father, Emily and Eliza Partridge came to live with Joseph and Emma to take care of their son, Don Carlos. Each of the sisters married the prophet at first without Emma's knowledge and then a second ceremony with her consent. Although he insisted that the practice of polygamy remain secret, Joseph Smith introduced his teaching about plural wives to 30 families of his close followers among the 20,000 Mormons living in and around Nauvoo. When he denied from the pulpit having plural wives, at least 100 other polygamous adults sitting in church knew about the secret doctrine. How did he convert his followers to the practice of plural marriage? One of the clearest records of how Joseph Smith persuaded married men to take additional wives comes from the pen of William Clayton. In his meticulous diary, Clayton first mentions plural marriage in early 1843. He had been married to his legal wife, Ruth, for 6 years and had 3 children. Smith called at his home and invited Clayton for a walk, during which he said he had learned of a sister back in England to whom Clayton was very much attached, and said, I give you the authority to send for her, and I will furnish you with the means, which he did, according to Clayton. There were other polygamous husbands in Nauvoo besides the prophet and his private clerk. Smith urged that plural marriage was essential for the church, warning that the church could not go on until that principle was established. Between April 5, 1841, and January 17, 1842, he took his first 4 officially recorded plural wives, the above-mentioned Louisa Beeman, Zina D. Huntington, Priscinda L. Huntington, and Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner. Theodore Turley, Brigham Young, Jonathan Holmes, Reynolds Cahoon, and Heber C. Kimball each took 1 plural wife in 1842. Smith continued on to marry 14 more women that year, making a total of 23 plural wives he and his associates had married by the end of 1842. On January the 7th, 1843, Benjamin Mitchell took the 24th plural wife. Other new polygamous husbands in 1843 included Willard Richards, Thomas Bullock, William D. Huntington, Lorenzo Dow Jones, Joseph Bates Noble, William Clayton, James Byrd, Orson Pratt, Parley Pratt, James Adams, Orson Hyde, William Felshaw, Amasa Lyman, Hiram Smith, John Baer, Henry Lyman Cook, Ebenezer Richardson, John Taylor, and Edwin D. Woolley. In addition, Joseph Smith contributed 15 more women to the total of 43 new plural wives in 1843. In 1844, up to June 27th, when the prophet was killed, Erastus Snow, John D. Lee, Ezra T. Benson, and Dominicus Carter became polygamists. And 19 more plural wives in that half year made a grand total of 85 plural marriages in the Nauvoo community while Joseph Smith was still alive. The 30 polygamous husbands from 1841 up to Joseph Smith's death in 1844 had married a total of 115 legal and plural wives who had borne 143 children. These men averaged 36 years of age, had been married to an average of 10 years before marrying a second wife of a mean 25 years of age. At that time, their legal wives averaged 32 years of age, 4 years younger than their husbands and seven years older than the first plural wife at the time of her marriage. At the time of these first plural marriages, the nuclear family included an average of 4 pre-polygamous children. And during the Nauvoo years, these families would grow to include an average of 7 wives and 6 children. In the post-Nauvoo years, these original 30 families would eventually accumulate an average of 11 wives and 26 children each. Without Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and Heber Kimball, which were the largest married families, these families averaged 4 wives and 5.4 children during the Nauvoo years and ultimately 7.5 wives and 24.7 children each. I thought at this point, having had some of the numbers, you might be interested in the living conditions, which come from the diaries. And there are a lot of remarkably articulate diaries from both plural wives and polygamist husbands. The Nauvoo Temple was the centerpiece of the physical and social arrangements of Nauvoo polygamy. Sarah Rich wrote of the temple work she and her husband Charles did during the wave of marriages in January and February 1846, quote, "We were to be there at 7 in the morning and remain until the work was done at 10 or 12 at night, if necessary. So we got a good girl, Mary Phillips, a wife of my husband, to stay and take care of the children, and we helped in the house of the Lord. Plural wives sometimes worked as servants in the home of the first wife, often hiding the special relationship they had with the man of the house. They had to disguise their pregnancies from citizens who had not been aware of the secret doctrine, and accept their contempt for loose women when babies were apparently born out of wedlock. Plural wives were frowned upon by some legal wives who knew about the doctrine and feared that Joseph Smith might ask their husbands to practice it. Plural wives entered polygamy with varying degrees of enthusiasm. Priscindia Huntington, third recorded plural wife of Joseph Smith, wrote late in life that, in 1841, I entered into the new and everlasting covenant, was sealed to Joseph Smith, the prophet and seer, and to the best of my ability, I have honored plural marriage, never speaking one word against the principle. I have been the mother of 9 children, 7 sons and 2 daughters, 2 by my last husband, Heber Chase Kimball. Never in my life, in this kingdom, which is 44 years, have I doubted the truth of this great work." Plural wife Sarah Studevant Levitt of Nauvoo recalled, "It was whispered in my ear by a friend that the authorities were getting more wives than one. She reasoned that the anointed of the Lord would not get more wives unless they were commanded to do so." Mary Horn found that she could work out her individual character separate from her husband. She felt freer and able to do individually things she could never have attempted before. Lucy Walker, who was on intimate terms with Joseph Smith's other wives, the Partridge and Lawrence sisters, experienced, quote, "less room for jealousy when wives live under the same roof." She said, "instead of feeling of jealousy, plural marriage was a source of comfort to us." And as you might imagine, some women wrote frankly about their difficulties with polygamy. Mary Ellen Kimball recorded Heber C. Kimball's analogy. First, Lucy Walker Kimball regarded polygamy as a grand school to learn self-control, self-denial. So there was some effort to live that practice. And Mary Ellen Kimball recorded Heber C. Kimball's analogy that plural marriage should be like a dish of water into which he puts a quart and his wives each put a pint. She grasped the essence, so you see our will swallowed up in his will. Well, the dilution of a woman's will would certainly offend 20th century feminine sensibilities, extended to the subjugation of wives by polygamous husbands. Eventually husband to 45 wives, Heber C. Kimball wrote that the wives should be, quote, "in subjection to their husbands." He preached, "I am subject to my God, my wife is in subjection to me, and will reverence me in my place, and I will make her happy." Kimball justified this dominance of women with the view that man was primary in a creation which only secondarily came up with a woman for man to use. Quote, "The man was created, and God gave him dominions over the whole earth, but he saw that he never could multiply and replenish the earth without a woman. And he made one and gave her to him. He did not make the man for the woman, but the woman for the man, and it is just as unlawful for you to rise up and rebel against your husband as it would be for man to rebel against God." Is my wife here, by the way? She's not there? Okay. Other polygamous Nauvoo husbands affirmed their authority over women. Amasa Lyman, who eventually married 8 wives, lectured to the priesthood holders in the Nauvoo temple, quote, "A man becomes responsible for his own conduct and that of his wife. We want the man to remember he has covenanted to keep the law of God, and the woman to obey her husband." George A. Smith, husband to 7 wives, agreed that the woman ought to be in subjection to the man, be careful to guard against loud laughter, against whispering, levity, and tale-bearing. And Brigham Young, who married at least 33 women, some would say 55, wrote that women will never get back unless she follows the man back. The man must love his God, and the woman must love her husband. And Martha Spence Haywood expressed a stoic attitude toward plural marriage. Quote, "I tried to recognize the hand of the Lord in all of this for the perfecting of my character." Well, it wasn't only women who had opinions, positive or negative. People of both genders expressed, in this case, some anguish over polygamy. Nauvoo polygamist Joseph Fielding wrote in the 1840s and 50s of dissent within the Mormon community. "This is my greatest trial," he wrote. "I think there is nothing more, there is more trouble on the subject of plural marriage than anything else. It appears in general to have given great offense to the wife. Some of the best of our sisters are tyrannized over by some of the meanest." He bemoaned that "my wives have not spoken to each other for many months." Patty Sessions, plural wife to Joseph Smith as well as the first wife of Mr. Sessions, spoke of her husband's preference for another wife. "I feel very bad. He took Harriet to the farm with him and leaves me here alone." Victoria Hancock Jackson resented that some men neglected present wives with children were captivated by a younger face. Does that ever happen? Emmeline B. Wells spoke of being tortured by her husband's inattention. "If my husband could only love me a little and not seem to be perfectly indifferent." Adelia Almira Wilcox Hatton Wood Kimball left her first plural marriage because her husband's first wife considered a plural wife to be nothing more than a concubine. And Adelia felt that she and her children were looked upon as intruders. Jane Richards spoke of feeling like wringing the neck of any other child than hers that should call her husband Papa. Well, then we have the unconvinced, those who didn't want to join plural marriage. There were a few of those. Emily Austin, whose sister married polygamist Newell Knight, escaped to Ohio to avoid this, quote, horrible practice. Rachel Grant, mother of future LDS president Heber J. Grant, wrote, "I'd rather be a single wife in hell than a whore in heaven." I was laying it on the line. Even the prophet occasionally faced rejection. In the spring of 1842, Joseph Smith told Sarah Pratt, wife of Apostle Orson Pratt, that the Lord wanted him to take her as his spiritual wife. Sarah refused Smith's offer and eventually exposed him to her husband. After he confronted Smith, Orson Pratt was excommunicated but reinstated 5 months later. After Smith's death, Pratt took himself plural wives, and he became the primary apologist for plural marriage when it was officially announced in Utah in 1852. Sarah ultimately left both Orson and the church. She labeled polygamy the direst curse, which completely demoralizes good men and makes bad men correspondingly worse. As for the woman, she wrote, well, God help them. When Smith proposed in April of 1842 to Nancy Rigdon, the daughter of his close friend and counselor, Sidney Rigdon, he reportedly took her into a room, locked the door, and then stated to her that he had had an affection for her for several years and wished that she should be his. Nancy refused him, saying that she would only marry a single man. The following day, Smith explained to her in a letter, "That which is wrong under one circumstance may be, and often is, right under another." He added, "Whatever God requires is right, no matter what it is, although we may not see the reason thereof." She remained unconvinced. Any discussion of resistance to plural marriage is incomplete if it doesn't mention Emma Smith's reluctance to accept co-wives. Joseph's plural marriage revelation went so far as to threaten Emma with destruction if she did not comply. She responded by reportedly throwing the written revelation into the fire. And after Joseph Smith died, she consistently denied that her husband had ever practiced polygamy. According to Lucy Merzerv Smith, Emma, quote, "bore testimony to me that Mormonism was true as it came forth from the servant of the Lord, Joseph Smith, but said that the 12 had made bogus of it. She said they were living with their plural wives and raising children, and Joseph never taught any such doctrine." Eventually, Emma Smith left the church and allowed the majority of Mormons under the leadership of Brigham Young to migrate west without her. She became a member of the RLDS Church, headed by her son, Joseph Smith III. Well, considering the explosive nature of what was taking place, Nauvoo polygamy was surprisingly well concealed. The words of early polygamists convey Joseph Smith's need for secrecy. Lucy Walker said that Joseph lived in constant fear of being betrayed. Jane Richards explained that when Joseph Smith had taken more wives a few months previous to his death, he received a revelation in regard to polygamy that he should do it without publicity. Joseph Lee Robinson tells the story that if I should reveal things that God has revealed to me, there are some in the stand that would cut my throat or take my heart's blood. And one such person who had a difficult time bearing plural marriage recalled that the doctrine of spiritual wives was taught privately in the church in Nauvoo in 1841, but that he was invited to participate in 1843. Hiram instructed me in November, December to make a selection of some young woman, and he would seal her to me, and I should take her home. And if she should have an offspring, give out the word that she had a husband, an elder, who had gone on a foreign mission. In possible reference to a secluded birthplace or conceivably abortion, Robinson spoke ominously of, quote, a place appointed in Iowa, 12 or 18 miles from Nauvoo, to send female victims to his polygamous births, unquote. The motifs of caution and danger recur in the stories of early polygamy. When the pregnancy of William Clayton's first plural wife threatened to expose him, the prophet advised Clayton to, quote, just keep her at home and brook it, and if they raise trouble about it and bring you before me, I will give you an awful scourging and probably cut you off from the church, and then I will baptize you and set you ahead as good as ever. According to church historian Andrew Jensen, Sarah Ann Whitney became the seventh wife, plural wife of Joseph Smith, and the story of his marriage to her illustrates another strategy. She disguised her relationship to the prophet by pretending to marry Joseph Corydon Kingsbury on April 29, 1843. In his autobiography, Kingsbury wrote, I, according to President Joseph Smith and Council and others, agreed to stand by Sarah Ann Whitney as though I was supposed to be her husband and participated in a pretended marriage for the purpose of bringing about the purposes of God in these last days. 3 weeks later, while Joseph Smith was in hiding, he wrote a revealing letter, which he addressed to her parents, Newell and Elizabeth Whitney, inviting them to bring their daughter to visit him, quote, just back of Brother Hiram's farm. He advised Brother Whitney to, quote, come a little ahead and knock at the southeast corner of the house at the window. He assured them, especially Sarah Ann, that it is the will of God that you should comfort me now. He stressed the need for care to find out when Emma comes, but when she is not here, there is the most perfect safety. The prophet warned them to burn this letter as soon as you read it and keep all locked up in your breasts. In closing, he admonished, I think Emma won't come tonight. If she don't fail to come tonight. In 1845-46, after now-widowed Sarah Ann went to live with Heber C. Kimball, her husband for a time, Kingsbury married his own plural wives. Most of Smith's wives, plural wives, boarded with other families whom he visited periodically. His secretary, William Clayton, recorded one such visit to young Almira Johnson on May 16, 1843. President Joseph and I went to Benjamin F. Johnson's to sleep, which is all that Clayton writes. Johnson himself, however, wrote in a statement that in this visit, Smith stayed with Almira as man and wife and occupied the same room and bed with my sister that the previous month he had occupied with the daughter of the late Bishop Partridge as his wife. Almira Johnson also confirmed the secret marriage to Joseph Smith. Quote, I lived with the prophet Joseph as his wife, and he visited me at the home of my brother, Benjamin F. There are a number of discussions of the code of silence and the reluctance of plural wives to discuss some anxiety they have. Am I getting close to time here? Okay. I just want to close with a couple of comments about the incidence of Nauvoo polygamy after Joseph Smith's death. While the journals and personal writings tell a complex human story, the numbers create a picture of their own. Now, we've been to the stories. We'll go back to the numbers for a moment. After Joseph Smith's death, the number of plural marriages in Nauvoo began to increase rapidly. In the fall of 1844, Heber C. Kimball took 9 wives, Brigham Young 4, Parley P. Pratt 3, William Clayton, Isaac Morley, George A. Smith each took a pair of wives. Of the 41 plural marriages in 1841, 31, or 75%, took place after the prophet's death, and 6 were to former wives of the prophet. At least 20 of Smith's wives were married for time to other men, such as Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball, 15 during the 1844 to 46 period in Nauvoo. They continued, however, to be sealed for eternity to the dead prophet. Plural marriage accelerated even more in the winter of 1845-46 after the temple opened on December the 10th, and it became clear that the westward migration would actually take place. Therefore, there was urgency. Brigham Young urged priesthood holders to take plural wives during their brief use of the newly opened temple. Heber Kimball, Brigham Young, John Taylor, John Bernheisel, John Smith, William Miller, Peter Hawks, John D. Lee, Willard Richards, Amasa Lyman, Lorenzo Snow, Winslow Farr, and Charles C. Rich led the way with a total of 105 wives. By this time, Smith's inner circle of 30 polygamous husbands had broadened to over 150 men. Over the 6 years when polygamy was practiced in Nauvoo, Smith, Kimball, and Young accounted for about 205 of the 549 polygamous marriages. At the funeral of his wife, Violet, Heber C. Kimball, pointing to the coffin, said, quote, "There lies a woman who has given me 44 wives." During the years after the westward migration, considering post-Nauvoo children of Nauvoo wives and later wives of earlier Nauvoo families, the practice expanded. The 154 families that began practicing plural marriage in Nauvoo eventually accounted for a total of 750 wives and about 2,900 children. This incorporated a mean incidence of 6.5 wives and 21.6 children per each family. And now, these preliminary demographic conclusions indicate that the practice of plural marriage, which Joseph Smith indicated among 30 families, ultimately more than quadrupled in total number of participants, husbands, wives, and children, by the end of the Nauvoo period in 1846. And then these same families in size of individuals tripled from the end of the Nauvoo period to the later Salt Lake period. These Nauvoo roots of Mormon polygamy eventually encompassed about 4,000 people, which expanded in Utah territory to include tens of thousands of men, women, and children, involving over half the population of some Mormon communities. The discovery and rejection of this relatively unknown doctrine by a vocal minority in Nauvoo seems to have been one of the primary factors leading to Joseph Smith's death. One historian concludes, "Joseph Smith's belief in, preaching about, and practice of plural marriage must be considered as one of the factors precipitating the martyrdom." After Smith was killed, Brigham Young pushed completion of the temple and accelerated plural marriages. When the Mormons were then forced to leave to Mexico, i.e. the Great Salt Lake, they were able to practice in some freedom, but then soon after they had to flee to Mexico again, now then below the Rio Grande. And remnants of these families, these expatriate colonies, still exist in Mexico. Many polygamists who persisted in their belief in the divine sanction of their practice remained in the United States, now reported to number over 30,000. These fundamentalist Mormons have endured years of government prosecution joined by official LDS cooperation, but they now practice their beliefs in relative freedom, mostly in Utah and Arizona. Well, what do LDS people today think about polygamy in the early Nauvoo church? Since that period was surrounded by secrecy and denials, and the practice was not announced until 1852 from a new home in Salt Lake, Nauvoo polygamy has remained essentially a mystery. The prophet's mother concluded that Joseph Smith only taught plural marriage, but we have no knowledge that anyone practiced it until the later Salt Lake period under Brigham Young. And today, it seems that Latter-day Saints generally identify reports of Nauvoo polygamy with anti-Mormon propaganda, which is considered to be based on unfounded rumors of Joseph Smith's illicit marriages. The community of 154 polygamous husbands, 549 plural wives, and 750 children has remained beneath the horizon of perspective. But many Latter-day Saints today, especially those who have polygamous ancestors, take pride in the patient, faithful men and women who practiced plural marriage long ago and made it work. Even though LDS men generally take one legal wife today, many devout Mormons still believe in the principle, and when a wife dies, may be sealed to more than one woman for eternity. The present doctrine of celestial marriage, which includes the promise of plural marriage in the afterlife, and the current plural marriage among fundamentalist Mormons, are the legacies of Joseph Smith's revelation sanctioning Nauvoo polygamy as a new and everlasting covenant. Thank you.
I'm pleased to comment on George's paper because of the issues that it raises and because of the implications that it suggests, the breadth of those implications, and it is chiefly about such implications that I wish to remark. The research presented here is part of a growing body of scholarship focusing on Mormon polygamy. This paper is especially valuable because it reinforces ideas that are becoming increasingly clear as our study of polygamy goes forward. I will outline what some of these issues and considerations are. We should first notice that the advocacy of polygamy was widespread, both in England and the United States during the 18th and early 19th centuries. An English writer discussing the matter less than a century before Joseph Smith said enthusiasm for polygamy had become an epidemic. Mormon interest in the practice was then not new. I have found in my own research that some of Joseph Smith's disciples admitted they had been thinking about polygamy even before it was first introduced to them by the young prophet. In other words, it was in the air, and while some later said they were shocked by the idea, we might consider the need to qualify such statements, knowing now what we do. Certainly, however, Joseph Smith took the lead with the practice of plurality, at least among Mormons, perhaps. As George points out in his paper, Joseph's involvement would be felt. If indeed the 1831 revelation occurred, sanctioning plural marriage as a means for whitening the skins of Native Americans, it is interesting, so far as I know, that Joseph himself never married an American Indian, never used the practice in his own life for the eugenic ends described in the 1831 communication. In any case, as George's paper indicates, by the time of the 1843 revelation, Joseph Smith had already taken at least a dozen white women, apart from his wife Emma, as plural companions. One of the things I found fascinating in George's paper was the calculation he made, showing that between the time of Joseph's first official plural marriage in 1841 to Louisa Beeman and the end of 1843, the prophet averaged 1.5 new wives each month. I'm not sure which half he married. This is a dizzying pace. If one assumes that some time, at least, must have been required for courtship, even with secret, abbreviated honeymoons, such activities must have taken up a considerable amount of Joseph Smith's time. These statistics confirm comments by both William Clayton, Joseph's secretary, and a remark made later in the century by the prophet's nephew, Joseph F. Smith, that in the year or two before his death, Joseph seemed obsessed with polygamy. Another of George's points, and one that has been made by others, although it yet elicits disbelief and embarrassment on the part of many in the church, is that Joseph chose as some of his partners women who were already married. What makes this especially difficult to swallow is that some of these women were the wives of his own apostles, or the friends or daughters of the friends of Emma. George compares this. I don't believe he was able to treat this in the time that he had in his verbal presentation, but he compares this practice by Joseph to the old medieval practice of the droit de seigneur. My own view is that Joseph simply approached those to whom he was attracted with only a secondary or tertiary interest in rationale. But to be sure, he did claim in certain cases that a special bond existed between himself and another's wife, something perhaps that extended back into the pre-existence. This is, of course, very, very close to notions of spiritual wifery, being advocated by several other non-Mormon groups at the time. And we ought to remember Mormons themselves, especially in those early years, sometimes used the phrase spiritual wife to describe what they were doing. Of course, the other reason adduced, as George maintains, was that men of higher priesthood or of a higher calling in the priesthood might claim the wife of another if the wife involved were willing. This is a messy business that I have never understood, but one that strikes me as productive only of a great deal of heartache and tragedy. The stories of Henry B. Jacobs and Norman Buell and Adam Leitner, all of whom had spouses taken by Joseph, are among the saddest of cases for me in Mormon history. And it will take a more profound theologian than I am to ferret out the justice of a religious doctrine that permits such a practice. George's comment that as many as 8 individuals have been identified as possible children born to Joseph Smith from these plural alliances raises another old but pressing question. Why is there so little evidence on this, so few instances, if there are any at all, that can be found to show that Joseph did indeed have sexual commerce with other women? If one rejects abortion or other techniques of birth control as resorts in these cases, one is left with only 2 possible answers. The first is that such children were born, but that we have to this point simply been unable to positively identify them. The second is that for whatever reasons, conception, though desired, seldom happened. For decades, the reorganized church used this as a central argument in its contention that Joseph had not practiced polygamy and that it was an invention of Brigham Young. The Utah Mormon Church has not been particularly successful in answering the RLDS on this point. President George Albert Smith and others offered what seems to me an especially feeble reply, with the suggestion that the reason so few children resulted from Joseph's plural marriages was because everything was done in such hurried and stressful circumstances. As President George Albert Smith put it, Joseph was so hounded by his enemies he just couldn't make connection with women at the right times of month. On further thought, however, it may have been a good answer. George makes the interesting observation in his paper that Joseph's relationships were consistently of a quite transient nature. Unlike most later polygamous contractions by others, Joseph's wives were almost never set up in separate households. His marriages almost never resulted in anything like a family. Rather, they were secret, furtive, and concerned more with the making and consummating of an alliance, it would seem, than with the creation of plural households and families. As such, such transient relations, then, might well account in part for the want of pregnancies in Joseph's plural marriages. Even if this were so, given the more than 40 marriages George and others have found the prophet to have entered, one would think a larger number of births than seems to be the case could be found. Still, the 8 children that this paper identifies as possible polygamous offspring of the prophet constitutes a nucleus of evidence, a beginning on this fascinating question. Something also needs to be said about the number of plural marriages George finds to have occurred before the time of Joseph Smith's birth, or Joseph Smith's death. He counts 27 plural marriages associated with the men apart from Joseph Smith, if I read his paper correctly, making for about 150 adults in Nauvoo society involved in such arrangements during the prophet's lifetime. One's first impulse is to look upon this as a relatively small number that were involved in polygamy in Nauvoo. If Nauvoo had a population of around 20,000, this means that less than 1 in every 200 people were practicing polygamy. Although this was considerably less than the number that would enter the principal after the prophet's death, it was enough to generate rumor and make for trouble. There are few secrets that, if known by 150 people, will not sooner or later become known to many more. This leads to one of the major conclusions of the paper, and one with which I fully concur: the significance of polygamy as a reason for the assassination of Joseph Smith. As George indicates, only a few historians have acknowledged the importance of plural marriage as a problem in Nauvoo and as one contributing to his death. But it was a source of fierce private debate, not only between Joseph and Emma, but between Joseph and other church members like William Law. Joseph had been formally charged with both adultery and polygamy by a Carthage grand jury. It was one of the allegations made against him in the Expositor, and must be counted as among the reasons Joseph was so anxious to have the paper destroyed. This brings me to my last comment. George goes to some length providing several examples of not only secrecy but denial employed by Joseph and others in connection with polygamy. One of the unfortunate features of the polygamy story in Nauvoo was that Joseph and those associated with him in the practice had to lie about it. Polygamy, it seems, from those years until at least two decades past the manifesto, was sheltered by dissimulation, false denial, and the use of code words to cover what was actually happening. This may have been necessary. More than one church authority later admitted that dishonesty was employed, but that it was justified as necessary for the safety of the saints. It is also worth noticing that, like the period after the manifesto, not only was mistruth used when talking to outsiders about polygamy, but it was used when talking to members of the church as well. Indeed, when talking to some high officials of the church. In both Nauvoo and after the 1890 manifesto, a kind of compartmentalization occurred, leading to divisions and confusions among the saints themselves. Since that will be the subject of another session in which I'm participating tomorrow, I'll say no more about it except to quote Emma Smith, who in a conversation with William Clayton after the death of her husband railed out against the practice of secrecy and false denial, saying that it was, quote, secret things, as she put it, that had cost Joseph and Hiram their lives. In conclusion, I find this a very interesting paper. I encourage George to continue with his study. For even in those instances that bring together things already known, he is helping us see more clearly than before how genuinely significant polygamy was in the history of the Nauvoo period, and indeed in the history of the 19th century church generally. His is one of a growing number of such studies that are giving plural marriage a closer examination than it has ever had before. And this lengthening shelf of inquiry, by telling us more about the early church, as with all humane scholarship, is also telling us more about ourselves.
I think we will all agree that we have heard two very good speakers, as well as the one distressed one. And I think we can all agree again in giving a heartfelt round of applause to our speakers. I'm afraid there is no time left for questions. There are, however, tapes available in the lobby of this session. Thank you all for coming and enjoying it.